For so long in Southern Baptist life, we just take one poor soul and say, all right, go up into the hinterlands and start a church. God bless you in the way. And you know how much value there is in that. So in our church planting strategy at Valley, we planted over 20 churches. Like our church in San Francisco that we planted, we sent, I think, 16 or 17 people. I said, we're doing it just like Schubel. The way the old Baptist preachers did it in Appalachia will work in California in 2025.
From Tri-State Bible College and the Appalachian Ministry Institute, this is the Level Paths Podcast. We're glad you've taken some time to join us. My name is Chris Weigel. One of the main objectives of the Level Paths Podcast is to bring up discussions about how to effectively minister to and spread the gospel in Appalachia. The traditions and ways of life in Appalachia are unique, and Level Paths aims to embrace the good parts of that uniqueness. But have you ever stopped to wonder what unique parts of Appalachia have been good for other parts of America? How has Appalachia had an impact on others, even 3,000 miles away? On this episode of Level Paths, Rex and Matt have a conversation with Pastor Phil Neighbors, whose family background connects him all the way back to the Great Awakening and Schubel Starnes. Of course, that all started in Sandy Creek, North Carolina in the mid-18th century. The thing is, Pastor Phil pastors a church in Bakersfield, California. So what's the connection? Here's Rex.
Welcome back to another Level Paths podcast. My name is Rex Howe. I serve as the president of Tri-State Bible College. I'm here with my brother, Pastor and Dr. Matt Shamblin. Matt, how is today in Kentucky?
Things are looking good in Kentucky. I mean, we're having a heat wave. I think it is 31 degrees here right now, which is a far cry from the 10 degrees that it was yesterday. So we are thrilled to death. After this, I'm going to go swimming.
Awesome. Awesome. Not in my pool, you're not. Well, we have a special guest with us today, Pastor Phil Neighbors. Phil served as the church planter and pastor of Valley Baptist Church since 1985 when he planted it. He serves there still as pastor emeritus, and Valley Baptist Church is located in Bakersfield, California. And I can already think, Matt, as our listeners, our friends are joining in the conversation here, what is a guy from California going to know and talk to us about with regard to Appalachia?
They're going to be shocked. They're going to be surprised. This brother and I were introduced from our mutual friend, Jonathan, who leads Chosen Road. Chosen Road's a favorite of our conference. And he said, you got to meet my pastor, Phil. And so he introduced us and I called Phil and we talked for about 2 hours. I told Rex, I said, man, we've got to make sure that this happens. We got to get Phil on the podcast. We'll be able to have multiple hours worth of content, but we're going to try to limit that because Phil's going to, Lord willing, going to be with us at our Appalachian Ministry Conference, and you're going to learn why. Just in a moment, you're going to learn why. Phil, welcome to the Level Paths Podcast.
Thank you so much.
So tell us, how does a guy who's from California or spent so much time in California, how does a guy like yourself get interested in Appalachia? And let's just leave it at that. How does a guy like yourself get interested in Appalachia?
Well, my ancestors all came from Appalachia country. Probably the closest to you that my family lived was Paintsville, Kentucky, which is just down the road. I looked on the map a few minutes ago. It may be an hour down the road or less. I don't know. I've never been to where the Tri-State Bible College is. So my grandparents on both sides of my house came from Kentucky and Tennessee. So I grew up in, even though I was born and reared in Oklahoma, I had a very Appalachian cultural influence on my life.
Well, so let's talk about that. You planted and pastored a church in Bakersfield, California. Now, being from Appalachia, living my life in Appalachia, I mean, that's the big city. That might as well be on Mars compared to where I'm from. But as we talked, the influence of Appalachia, and that's one of the things I want to talk about. This is no small church. This is what we would call an ultra mega church now that was planted really not all that long ago, about 40 years ago. You know, too often when you have Appalachian roots, when you talk like I do, you're told, hey, wait a minute, you have limited influence, limited ability, limited impact. But tell us about that Appalachian influence and how on earth could somebody with such deep roots in the influence of Appalachia, How could that make it in Bakersfield, California?
Well, migration. In Appalachian studies, I'm sure there's been research and a lot of discussion about Appalachian out-migration. I know in your part of the world, I think it probably went north up into Ohio, obviously. Dayton, we hear these stories about all the way up to Chicago, right, and Detroit. But also, the Appalachian culture moved west. As I said, my grandparents were all from Kentucky and Tennessee and North Carolina going way back. And my ancestors were impacted greatly by the First Great Awakening and the Great Revival that happened in beginning, I guess most people will probably pinpoint 1755 at Sandy Creek Baptist Church in North Carolina. I have a number of references to my family being directly involved in that, being converted in that same ministry, and then they became church planters as they moved out from central North Carolina into eastern Kentucky. In fact, one of my ancestors planted a church called Jenny's Creek Baptist Church between Prestonburg and Paintsville. So as they came out, it seemed like they would migrate about 100 to 150 to 200 miles, almost on a straight line west. So if you start off at, let's say, Paintsville, Kentucky, and you just keep going west, you're going to wind up in Bakersfield. So all I did was what my ancestors did. We just kept coming across. But the impact of Appalachian Christianity in that first generation, the 1750s, the first and second Great Awakening, my ancestors were at the Cane Ridge Revival on my mother's side in Paris. They lived in Paris. And in fact, one of my cousins delivered an address at Cane Ridge Revival memorial ceremony to recognize, I forget what anniversary it was here, about 2 years ago. So I had it coming from both ways, First and Second Great Awakening, that had a big impact on Appalachia. We moved to Oklahoma, my family did. I moved to Bakersfield, and we've been able just to carry that faith with us, my family, all along the way. So migration from Appalachia, I think, is very important. And maybe if you stayed back there, I understand, well, we're nobodies, but I think there's a lot that can be said about what's happened as they left.
That's right. I mean, those of us who have studied it, we're familiar with the out-migration. And Phil, you're right about if families who are in the southeastern county, Appalachian counties of Ohio, plus a lot of the would be the northwestern parts of West Virginia, a lot of those went, for example, to Akron, Ohio during the rubber boom. So There's this fun article that written called How Akron Became the Capital of West Virginia. About how all these families moved there because of work. They took their culture with them. Now, here's something that's interesting, Phil. My family, my mom's side, were tobacco farmers in Sayersville, Kentucky, McGauphin County. And I have stories from my childhood about some of our relatives who went west to Oklahoma.
Yes.
That's not something I've tracked down a lot, but that's part of our family story as well.
The migration from my family is the exact story. And my grandpa was in Cumberland County, Kentucky. And in 1910, he moved out to Oklahoma. And I remember asking Grandpa, why did you leave those beautiful hills of the Cumberland Mountains? And he said one word. And I said, what is it? And he said, cotton, you know, farming land. And so Appalachian migration just continued. And my experience of it, they kept with them their Appalachian accent. I probably got still just a twang of it myself. At least I'm told that here in California. Their music, food, Kentucky cooking is what my mama called it, and certainly our faith. It seems like in migration, as those who migrate, they have a tendency to hang on maybe to those values, maybe more so than what were in Appalachia. Like we moved from Oklahoma out to California. Well, the Oklahoma culture may be as strong here as it is back there, because something about migration, you kind of hang on to it as a tradition.
I wanted to ask you about what year in your family that migration from Kentucky to Oklahoma happened. And the reason I want to ask is I'm teaching church history in Appalachia right now. And what I'm seeing, there was a Christian influence from the First Great Awakening that came from the Northeast into Appalachia through Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And there was also the Southern, Shubal Starnes and those who came up from the south into north-central Appalachia. And so about what year would your family have migrated out?
If I take it all the way back, my furthest back ancestors that I know I can trace, they moved from Morristown, New Jersey, down to the Yadkin River area of North Carolina, right next to the Boone family. And as they came down there, they had been converted into the ministry of a pastor named John Gano, who started a church right on the Yadkin River. And then Indian troubles came, and John Gano went back to his home country of New Jersey, wound up becoming pastor at First Baptist Church, New York City. Eventually, he becomes pastor of what is now First Baptist Church, Lexington, Kentucky. So, but my family stayed in North Carolina. So that would have been early on. In fact, Ebenezer Fairchild, who is my fifth great grandpa, who is a preacher, founded the Three Forks Baptist Church in Boone, North Carolina. And the Watauga County History has a whole chapter on him as being one of the very first permanent settlers into Boone, North Carolina area. That would have been about 1783. Then they just migrated into eastern Kentucky and further into Middle Tennessee and central Kentucky. The way I've traced them is churches. They started churches and they were preachers. I come from a long line of preachers. And so I've gone back now through the providence of God and been able to preach in many of the, almost all of them. I just call the preacher and say, hey, my grandpa started your church. And they always welcome me back. First Baptist Church, Mountain City, Tennessee, which is in the very tip corner of the northeastern Tennessee, was started in 1792 by my fifth great-grandpa. So it goes way back to the 1700s, and the migration just continued west. But my grandfather Fairchild, his diary records the early days of the Sandy Creek Revival, and he lists about 11 or 12 Sandy Creek Association preachers, including Schubel Starnes, Daniel Marshall, Philip Mulkey. I could go on and on. He heard them all and recorded them in his diary, telling about what they were like. So we were touched by the First Great Awakening. On Mama's side, they were touched by the Second Great Awakening in Cambridge, Kentucky. And so what a pipeline of spiritual heritage it was handed to me. And we've just been marching across the country with the gospel that Schubel Starnes preached back in 1755.
There's so much there for our listeners. I kind of want to trace this. So we have two different preachers that had an incredible impact, and they're both from the Northeast. When we look at Appalachian culture, it's very different. It's very unique. It's not Southern culture. It's not Northern culture. And much of the impact that was had as far as gospel impact didn't originate here, but you have guys like Schubel Starnes that made an incredible impact. And part of the impact was because he did not exactly, but close to what the Wesleys did with circuit riding preachers. They had a church planting movement that emanated from Sandy Creek. And these were pastors who were raised up right from that community. The name that I had never heard before was John Gano.
Yeah.
And if you were to look his name up online, you'll find a picture of him baptizing someone. Phil, I'll let you tell who he was baptizing in that picture.
He's baptizing George Washington by immersion.
By immersion. And so
he was a chaplain in the Revolutionary War.
And in fact, he was George Washington's favorite chaplain and yes, the man who prayed the last prayer before he dismissed the troops from the Revolutionary War.
In 1783 in New Windsor, New York. I think a great study is there, Rex, about Baptist preachers in the Revolutionary War. You know, Washington was an Anglican, but could you trust an Anglican priest in the Revolutionary War? And our Baptist brethren stepped up to the forefront in chaplaincy and became prominent, John Gano being probably the most prominent and the most influential. And he was a tremendous preacher, a brilliant mind. He went to Princeton when it was called College of New Jersey. So he was just brilliant and a tremendous communicator. And that was recognized by Gaines, by Washington, loved to hear him preach. He came from New Jersey, and of course, Schubel Starnes came from Connecticut. But they brought the gospel down to North Carolina. And if you know the story of the Sandy Creek Revival, it just took off and spread all the way to California.
Well, and that's what I find so amazing is we find a culture that seemingly cannot be penetrated by any stream of Christianity. And yet, let's just be honest, I'm going to use a term that, because I'm from here, I can use this, the most redneck streams of Christianity, whether it be the Baptist or the Methodists, they're the ones that make the greatest impact, not because they have the greatest training, and that spreads all the way across the country. And that's what I want to kind of talk a little bit about. What characteristics could you identify at Valley Baptist in Bakersfield, California, that you could say, hey, you know, this was really the influence of Appalachian Christianity? You'd talked about that in our conversation before.
Right. As I've deduced it down, first of all, you have to understand that as a child, I didn't know about Schubel Starnes or John Gano. I just was in a little Baptist church in Oklahoma. Then when I went to seminary under Paige Patterson, Dr. Paige Patterson was at Criswell College, and then later I got my D.Min under him at Southeastern. He began to talk to us about Schubel Starnes. And something rung familiar in my mind about that because of the location. Where was that? Because I knew my ancestors had come from there. So I began to study Schubel Starnes. I think I've tried to read everything on the topic, on the subject related to him and the Sandy Creek movement, knowing that my ancestors were there. And one of my ancestors actually recorded a big meeting, what they used to call a big meeting, which was an associational meeting, you know, attended by thousands. And he recorded the preachers he heard. So studying them, when we moved out here to California, how are we going to do this? And my study of the Sandy Creek movement in particular, and John Gano's ministry, we learned three things from them that we tried to employ or to do here, and it's been successful here. In fact, just before we started our podcast, I was on the phone to our church planner in Silicon Valley, in Campbell, California. After 7 years, he's running 250 people. Well, that's like running 2,500 people in Kentucky or Tennessee or somewhere. I mean, it's amazing what God's let him do. But anyway, we did the same thing with him. Three things that we tried to understand that Schubel Starnes did that we thought would work in California, and it did. One was passionate preaching, heartfelt preaching. And there's a lot you can learn about the Appalachian style of preaching probably comes from old Schubel Starnes. I used a term one time I call pleading preaching. You know, most of our teaching today is informational and instructional, but when does the last time the preacher ever just pled with the congregation to get right with God or be saved? I grew up under that kind of preaching, what I call pleading preaching. Now, if that's all you do for your congregation, it could be pretty shallow. But I think I would summarize like this: preaching to the heart, not just to the head. Touching the emotions. Is there something that's going to touch the heart? That's what I believe those Appalachian preachers did. Number two was their church planning was done in a cooperation together in teamwork. This church I just told you about that we planted successfully in Silicon Valley, I mean, Amazon on one end of town and Google on the other end of town, we did it like they did it. How did the Sandy Creek movement move? They moved in groups. For instance, the Sandy Creek church was started by 16 people. For so long in Southern Baptist life, we just take one poor soul and say, all right, go up into the hinterlands and start a church. God bless you in the way. And you know how much failure there is in that. So in our church planting strategy at Valley, we've planted over 20 churches. We developed that Sandy Creek model of we're going to send a preacher, but we're sending, like our church in San Francisco that we planted, we sent, I think, 16 or 17 people. I said, we're doing it just like Schubel. And guess what? It's a successful church. And then the third thing we learned from them, I think, was aggressive, confrontational evangelism. Not afraid to share the gospel. Take the initiative to share the gospel and leave the results with God. So passionate preaching, teamwork, church planning, and direct confrontational evangelism. We were told all along in California that particularly the confrontational evangelism will not work. We baptized our 10,000th person here about 2 months ago after 40 years. Daniel's baptized 50 this last year in San Francisco. So you know what? Let's don't listen to the lies. The way the old Baptist preachers did it in Appalachia will work in California in 2025. Those are kind of the things we carried, I guess you would say, culturally, traditionally, even the model of how we do things. And we're not just stuck in time. We're as up to date as anybody. But those core values or those core functions of ministry, I think just what I just said will work in Appalachia. I can tell you it will work in San Francisco. We learned from old Schubel Starnes and our Appalachian heritage, and we just carried it with us.
The Appalachian Ministry Conference is returning to Tri-State Bible College for a third year in 2025. On April 29th, Evangelism in Appalachia. If you're a ministry leader or pastor, or if you have a burden for reaching fellow Appalachians with the gospel, April 29th at Tri-State Bible College is designed just for you. The keynote speaker is Dr. David Wheeler, author and professor at Liberty University, and music is by Appalachia's very own Chosen Road. The Appalachian Ministry Conference this April 29th at Tri-State Bible College in South Point, Ohio. To find out more, visit tsbc.edu.
When we think about the church planting, even a whole different stream of Baptist life, the First Baptist Church of Charleston, South Carolina, it was a whole move. A whole community moved to plant that church. And these were folks who were very, very serious. They picked up their lives and moved to different communities. And when you talk about aggressive evangelism, can you kind of flesh that out? What's that look like when you're talking about aggressive confrontational evangelism?
I actually wrote my project in ministry at Southeastern on this. Could that work in the California milieu? Because we were always told that you can't be confrontational. You can't be aggressive. You can't share the gospel with someone you don't know. We were told that. Well, boy, that really limits the circle of who we can lead to Christ. So we basically took the old model of the Roman road, and we asked people, and we train our people, can I take a moment to share with you what the Bible says you need to know to go to heaven when you die? And zoop, run through the Roman road. And guess what? People get saved. And I'm sure that there's been instances where people were offended, but I'm surprised at how that's not the case. We can take the initiative to share the gospel, and we've got a whole congregation of people that are trained that way. Our team that we sent up, like I'm using Daniel, but I could cite other teams. We sent a group up there, 16, 17, and they just did evangelism, you know? So we're not that different. Now, if you went on the website at Eden Church and looked at them, they would look like the coolest, most sophisticated group of believers you've ever met or church that you'd ever come across, you know. I mean, the name of the church is Eden Church. But if you get down to the bottom of what they're doing exactly what Schubel Starnes did in 1755. We used them as a model to go across the country.
I love it. You used the model of, for our country, we can say ancient Baptist Christianity and use that to reach modern California with the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's incredible. So let's talk about John Gano for a little bit. We've seen the impact of Schubel Starnes. Tell us a little bit about John Gano. This is a name that I had not heard of.
Are you familiar with Lumpkin's book on the separate Baptist movement or something to that effect in the South? Lumpkin's book, he was Southern Baptist. But basically, Lumpkin's book is about Gano and Starnes, that these were the two leading lights. Gano came down from New Jersey. He was converted under the Tenants, which were Presbyterians, under the Whitfield ministry. And then he came down to North Carolina to plant a church, which he did in 1758. So see, that's just 3 years after the Sandy Creek movement began in 1755. Well, my ancestor, Ebenezer Fairchild, came with him. Was a part of that group, you see. They came down to start a church in North Carolina from Morristown, New Jersey. They brought a whole group of people with them. One of them being my fifth great-grandpa, who became a Baptist preacher, and then he started the movement west. So Gano lights a fire in the Yadkin region of north-central North Carolina. Schubel Starnes lights a fire just on the other side of the Yadkin River, in 1755. Well, in time, this is what how I was trained. Those two movements merged right there in North Carolina. Then they just continued going west and going even into Kentucky, and the rest is history. One of my favorite stories to tell, Matt, is about a wonderful lady in our church named Moretta Thomas. I used this as an illustration in a sermon at one point about Schubel Starnes. She came up to me after the service. She said, "Pastor Phil, I'm kin to Schubel Starnes." And I said, "Well, wait a minute, Moretta, let's talk about this." To make a long story short, she's a direct descendant of the Starnes family. Her family migrated to California from Arkansas in 1930s, and they started the first Southern Baptist church in the state of California, about 25 miles north of me. Her parents were part of that original congregation. So there's a direct line between Sandy Creek Church and the work of Gano merging. right here to the first Southern Baptist work in California in 1936. And today there's 2,000 Southern Baptist churches in the state of California. And Moretta's still a member of our church. She's a Starnes. Her mother was a Starnes. And she says you pronounce it Starnes, not Stearns. But it, to me, I just was flabbergasted. And I said, here it is again. To me, it's like God took this big old rock and thrown it into the ocean in 1755. And the rippling waves, they're still going, aren't they?
As I listen to you talk, I'm thinking the revival hasn't stopped.
No.
Because the people and the families who are impacted in 1755 are still planning churches, pastoring churches, leading churches, evangelizing. And so it's just, man, wow, if we think about revival in that way.
I've had that thought 1,000 times that I'm still in the Sandy Creek, John Gaino revival, 250 years later, whatever it is. And then in the 1970s, I was greatly impacted by the Jesus movement, 1972 revival. Well, if you go back and look at that, we don't have time to do that, but the flashpoint of that was in San Francisco by some young men from Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary witnessing on the streets of Haight-Ashbury in the 1968. Those were Southern Baptist boys that came out here. You see, the migration brought Southern Baptists out here in the 1930s, and that catalyst was this, it's still the Great Awakening waving on. So revival is a funny thing. Sometimes you don't even know you're in it till it's over with. You know, you look back and you go, my goodness. But I really think that the wave of the first Great Awakening has impacted California, and it had its real beginnings in Appalachia.
With all of that, there's this kind of idea of imperfection. You know, you've got these folks who don't listen to the critics. It can't be done.
No.
And so they do it. And we see the move of God. A few years ago, I was in Paris, Kentucky, and I knew the Cane Ridge Revival happened close by. And so I punched it into my GPS, and away I went and found myself at the Cane Ridge Meeting House. The Cane Ridge Meeting House is almost a sacred place for Campbellites.
Yeah.
And I posted a picture of me there, and I had somebody confront me on that. Hey, these are Campbellites. You know, that's not legitimate. But what you got to remember is that there was probably more than 20,000 people there. Mm-hmm. All of these people preaching at the exact same time, spread out all over these fields, and including multiple different, what we would call denominations, a lot of streams that ran through there. Mm-hmm. And so, no, what would have happened with Schubel Starnes, John Gaino, on and on we could go. We're not talking about everything has to be perfect for the move of God to take place. No. We're seeing the move of God taking place despite the imperfections, even as it starts in the Northeast, makes its way down to the Piedmont area of North Carolina, and reverberates even still to this day.
All the way to California.
All the way to California. I knew when we talked and you started to talk about Schubel Starnes as not Schubel Starnes, but Schubel Starnes, I thought, wait a minute, because even when I was taught about Schubel Starnes in seminary, my professor didn't realize that his name was pronounced Starnes. It's really only those who really dig into this do they recognize that.
Well, see, I was corrected by a Starnes family member. So I called him Schubel Starnes, you know, and she said, you know, Pastor Phil, we pronounce our name Starnes. She said, really, you should spell it S-T-A-R-N-E-S. And she said, we're Starnes. So the Starnes family, if you follow them, they went from North Carolina to Tennessee to Arkansas, right here to Central California in the San Joaquin. You can just, I can take Valley Baptist Church and get it back in five steps to Sandy Creek.
Phil, when I hear that, I am reminded of one simple truth, that it's the Lord Jesus Christ who builds his church.
Yeah. And it's something.
He may use men to do that, but it's ultimately him who's building it. And he does it with, thank God, he uses imperfect people to do that.
The first Southern Baptist Church of the state of California, a Starnes family was charter members. Starnes.
Awesome. With what you have said today, how would you speak to us as people still in Appalachia doing the Lord's work? and facing those migration challenges. You know, maybe one of us as pastors, and maybe we get a little discouraged when we see young people migrate. I was just doing statistics for our own local church and looking at the data about outward migration of young people. And like, wow, that's a lot of people that we're losing. Because you've reframed it here today. You've reframed the migration as revival continuing in other places.
Yes. Yes. I would say, and I have preached, I went back and found all the churches that my family was directly involved in, North Carolina, Eastern Kentucky, Tennessee. And one of the things I would tell those congregations is, I said, look, be faithful where you're at now. You have no idea over time what God could do through the light that burns in you here. I said, we're all the way out in California. That light's been handed to us 5 steps right straight from the Appalachian Mountains. I always challenge the congregations. Maybe in, a lot of these congregations were small that I preached in. You know, there's little groups of people, maybe 50, 60 or less I've preached. And I said, don't give up. Remember where we're at. Let's be prayer partners, you know. The second thing I would do is say, look at the possibility. I mean, this is the Sandy Creek movement. Migration is a ministry. I know with our International Mission Board, they have learned how important it is to minister to refugees, that they put a lot of time, energy, and money into refugee work. When there's conflict in the world and you've got mass movements of people, people are more prone to be responsive to the gospel in that kind of migration movement. So I know it's heartbreaking whenever a pastor's got a young couple and they're fired up and now they move to some far off place. But hopefully that's an investment in the gospel and go be a blessing where you're at. And that's part of our ministry. So be faithful where you're at. You never know how God's going to use you over time. You may not even, I mean, there's people back there in Tennessee and Kentucky who have no idea that we're connected like this. But they were faithful 150, 200 years ago. Look at the book of Acts. The church spread through migration because of persecution. So God's always used it this way, from the book of Acts to Shubal Starnes, John Gano, all the way here in California. And now we've spread the gospel every which way around the world.
Well, Phil, that's incredible and that's encouraging. There are so many pastors who are pastoring churches. They feel as though they're not significant. They're not making an impact. And we hear today that the impact that happens right there in those, what are really normative sized churches, can reverberate all around the world.
And you got to see that in the context of time too, don't you? You know, there's a wonderful book out there that I read not too long ago. The guy wrote it. It's Princeton Press. It's called From the Bible Belt to the Sun Belt. It's PhD level stuff. And he was going to do a book on Billy Graham from Princeton. And he goes, how in the world does a North Carolina born and reared man, you know, in the foothills of the Appalachians become the Christian world's leader in California? Because it all broke loose in 1949 down here in Los Angeles, of all places. That's part of that Appalachian movement, Billy Graham, right? And he wrote a book called From the Bible Belt to the Sun Belt. And basically, he was talking about the migration of Oklahomans, Texans, Louisianans, and Arkansas people to this part of the world. That was a mass migration in the 1930s. And what did they do? They brought their Christianity with them. In 1948, an Appalachian preacher, in a sense, Billy Graham, shows up out here, Scots Irish, shows up out here in California. And these people are already seated and planted and had churches, and they were the beginning, and he launched that whole thing. So once again, it's how the Holy Spirit uses migration. And I found that book to be fascinating. And he really takes it from Oklahoma, Texas region, but I know the rest of the story, including Billy Graham. It goes back to Appalachia, you see. It went from Appalachia to that central part of the United States out to the West.
You may be the pastor of a small church tucked away in the hills somewhere in West Virginia, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, or the Carolinas, and you may be wondering, what kind of impact am I really having? Well, consider this. What if there's a person in your church who, because of your ministry, has a spiritual fire lit and you know nothing about it? And if that person leaves your hometown, they take that fire with them wherever they go. Isn't it safe to assume that God could use your ministry to impact people thousands of miles away without your even knowing about it? Pastor Phil's story is a firsthand reminder that if we are faithful in planting the seeds, the harvest could spring up somewhere we never imagined it would. Tri-State Bible College and the Appalachian Ministry Institute exist as a resource. And no matter what need you may have, Rex Howe and Dr. Matt Shamblin want you to reach out to them today. Rex Howe is the president of Tri-State Bible College, and you can connect with him by email at rex.howe@tsbc.edu. And you can connect with Dr. Matt Shamblin at the Appalachian Ministry Institute by email, matt.shamblin@tsbc.edu. The Level Paths Podcast is an outreach of Tri-State Bible College and the Appalachian Ministry Institute.